Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
The Marine Corps is drafting back into service some of those who have already been discharged. As many as 2,500 Marines are being recalled to active duty. They'll be sent to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan starting next year. These are Marines who have already served, but they're kept on what's known as the Individual Ready Reserve List. In a moment, we're going to talk with a Marine who recently finished 4 years with the Corps. But first, Pam Hess, Pentagon correspondent for United Press International, joins us on the line. And Pam, how significant does this move?
It's pretty significant. The Marines haven't had to do this yet. The Army did in 2004. They ended up calling back about 5,000 people from the Individual Ready Reserve. The problem is that the Marines have already almost entirely used up their organized reserve units, who are units that would go over en masse. In the Individual Ready Reserve, they're activating individual Marines. The problem is that the law requires only a certain number of deployments for a reserve unit, and they have tapped that completely.
Well, let's talk about that in 1 second. But first, what kind of jobs will they be filling? What kind of need is there, basically?
It's for everything that you can imagine you would need in a war. Combat arms, which includes infantry and artillery guys, intel, military police, combat engineers. They're referred to as military occupational specialties, but these are not really specialties. These are the fundamental building blocks of a combat unit.
Can you explain just briefly the individual ready reserves as well, what that means?
Sure. When you sign up in the military, in the Marines in particular, I think like 60% of the people that go into their first part in the Marines will not go on to a second contract. So they work 4 years, but your contract is actually for 8 years. So you go in 4 years and then you have a choice. You can either sign up for the regular reserves or you can transition into civilian life, but you're part of the individual ready reserve. And that means you act like a civilian, you go to school, you have a job, and once a year you need to show up at the Marine base and then go back to your civilian life.
The Corps has said that Marines who recently served will be given a break here. How will those who will be chosen be chosen, basically?
I think what you'll find is that the people who have not already deployed or have only deployed once will be the ones that will go up first. I'll be actually surprised if some of these folks don't end up volunteering, figuring that they're going to be called to the IRR anyway. So it's the problem is that most of the Marines who did 4 years in the last 4 years have probably already put in two combat deployments, and then to have them transition into civilian life and then be pulled back in for another combat deployment is a pretty mean trick to play. So they're going to try to go back to the people who are at the very end of that eight-year commitment to try to find them. The problem is once you start tapping the IRR, there's sort of no end to it. This first tranche of people that will be contacted will be about 2,500 to fill 1,200 spaces because they realize that some of the people that they contact are just in a place in their life where they can't do it right now. But unless this war ends anytime soon, and it doesn't sound like it's going to, judging by what President Bush said, the IRR is probably going to continue to be tapped. And the Marines have said that there's no limit on the number, ultimately, that they may call, but they're going to do it in this first group coming in the next couple of months. They'll be notifying about 2,500 people.
Can you say what you think this recall says about how the U.S. military is doing and the strain on the military in Iraq and Afghanistan?
The strain is pretty high. Most combat units have put in two combat deployments already in the course of 3.5, 4 years, five if you count Afghanistan. And it's tough duty because this isn't, like going to Germany in the old days. This is actually every day being outside the wire in a very dangerous place. The Marines are assigned to Anbar Province, which is, when you hear about the Sunni Triangle, it's a big part of it. Fallujah, Ramadi, Al-Qaim, some of the most violent places in Iraq are what they're responsible for. So it is a strain on the Marines. I got a note from a senior general, and he said that they've just tapped out their organized reserves, and they need so many individuals for filling out current combat units for staff positions in Baghdad that they have to go this way. He said, the well has just run dry, and this is what we've got to do. The military was hanging on. I think they were hoping that the expected major decrease in troops, maybe bringing down from the current level about 138,000 down to about 100,000, $100,000 this year would happen, and that would provide a big relief to the military. But that hasn't happened, and instead the violence has gotten worse. So I think that they were sort of bare-knuckling it, thinking we can hold on, we can make it, we don't have to tap the IRR, we don't have to really dig in for a long term, because this year there's going to be a reduction. But of course that hasn't happened, and so now they're looking ahead and saying, you know, we can't send people back four times. We need to start bringing in some extra folks.
Right. Now, this news of the recall comes as a report's being issued today that says that the Marines don't have enough equipment. What do you think the overall picture is here in terms of the effect of the war on the U.S. Marines?
It's actually a weirdly mixed picture. The personnel are holding up well. The Marines haven't really had any trouble recruiting new folks. They don't really have a problem retaining them. The mismatch here is just that there are too many jobs to be done in Iraq for the number of people that are in the Marine Corps currently, which is about 181,000. There are a couple of issues that this goes into. One, the Marines have been trying to convince the Pentagon that this 181,000 number that they have needs to be maintained. The Pentagon plan is to bring them back down to 175 or even a little bit lower as soon as they can, as soon as this war is largely over or as soon as the commitment there is smaller. And the Marines are saying, you know, no, we're the first in force. We're already strained with just this Iraq and then periodic Afghanistan deployments. We need 181,000. And so they've been differing from the Pentagon on this. And the Pentagon is saying, no, we need to bring you down because the back of the envelope estimate is that for every 10,000 people that you add a year to the military, it costs about $1 billion. So the Pentagon's looking at the bottom line. The Marines are looking at their readiness. As far as the Marine equipment is concerned, they have been really using their stuff, their weapons and their vehicles in a very harsh environment in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's wearing out. The Marines spend not much compared to the other services every year in procurement. I think it's about $6 or $7 billion, and the bill for what they have to replace for just what's been used up in the war is $12 billion. So they're looking at, if they didn't buy anything that they had planned on buying for the next 3 years and just replace their equipment, they could cover the bills. But what they have to keep modernizing and buying new stuff in addition to refilling their weapon stock. So they're in a tough way. I talked to another senior official who's in budget negotiations right now, and they're calling it the Armageddon budget because it feels like the end of the world to them. They just don't know where the money's going to come from.
Pam, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Pam Hess is Pentagon correspondent for UPI. We turn now to Captain Seth Moulton, who left active duty service with the Marines in February. Seth spent about 2 years in Iraq. He spoke to us when he returned. Welcome back to our show.
Thanks very much, Deborah.
It sounds like, based on what Pam just told us, that you would be exempt from being among the first that would be recalled. Are you concerned, though, that you could still be activated?
Well, I actually recently joined what she referred to as a regular reserve unit. And so I belong to a reserve unit now that drills regularly in New Hampshire. And part of the reason I did that is specifically to avoid getting one of these cold calls over the phone to go back as part of the individual ready reserve. At least being part of a unit, I have an idea of when that entire unit will get deployed.
Do you think that this recall shows that there's a real strain on U.S. forces?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any question. I personally don't believe we have enough troops in Iraq or Afghanistan. And on top of that, we just don't have enough troops in the military. It's not surprising, but it's very frustrating. We don't have enough troops. No one's admitting that. We don't have the military capability to sustain this indefinitely. We're taking advantage of systems that were put in place for so-called national emergencies, not really ongoing conflicts. So I really worry about what would happen if another war were to break out, if Iran were to head south very quickly. Because if we don't even have enough troops to support our efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think it's silly to say that we're ready to jump right into some place like Iran should the need come.
Pam also mentioned this report being issued about the state of equipment and the costs of maintaining things in Iraq. How did you find the state of things when you were there?
It was tough at times. I mean, both times that I deployed to Iraq, we didn't have fully armored Humvees. We didn't have any armor at all the first time we went. The second time we had armored kits, but they weren't the fully armored Humvees that are now required. The first time we had trouble just getting the regular body armor. And these are really just basics. These are essentials. We're not talking about some of the real high-end weapon systems that enable us to do our jobs particularly well. Both times that I was over there, we had a lot of trouble getting things like advanced sights for our rifles or night vision equipment. And these are the kind of things that you really expect to have when you're a Marine.
Did you also feel the strain of not having enough people?
Personally, yes. Hmm. Yes. I don't know anyone on the ground in Iraq who feels that there are enough troops there.
You've had friends in the Army who've been recalled? Yes?
Yes.
What have their experiences been like?
Well, I think a lot of people perhaps, having heard about what the draft was like in Vietnam, assume that if they get called, they'll be able to get a deferment or something because of education. So I know some people in graduate school who've gotten called out of the individual ready reserve. And from what I've heard, there's no deferments. There's really very few exceptions. So I know Pam spoke of family hardship and whatnot, but I think that those kind of exceptions are pretty hard to come by. And so you could very well get pulled out right in the middle of the school year and have to go and serve your year, 2 years overseas, and then come back and finish things up when you return.
Mm-hmm. So what are you doing now since you've left in February? What have you been doing?
Well, I actually applied to grad school myself, and that is my plan.
And so if you did get recalled, how would this affect your plans?
Well, it would just have to be put completely on hold.
Mm-hmm.
And right. I wouldn't be able to go to school.
Since you left active duty, even before making plans to go to graduate school, you've been asked to return to Iraq. Is that right?
I have. I've been asked several times just over the phone to go voluntarily. And, you know, quite frankly, if I have to go to Iraq, I will go. I'm very proud of my time in the Marines, and I'm very proud of my time in Iraq. But I think that with my graduate school plans in mind, and considering the fact that, quite frankly, I spent two of the past 3 years in Iraq, I feel like it's time for a little bit of a break. And so every time I've been called so far, I've refused. I haven't accepted.
Weren't you frightened at all, saying if I do get called back into service, I may not be as lucky as I have been?
I think that's always part of it. I think that after you've been to a place like Iraq a few times, you certainly worry that maybe your luck's gonna run out. But at the same time, you know, if the need is there, I will go, and I feel strongly about that. I think Iraq is important, and I wouldn't be someone who would just refuse to go, but it certainly would be with some reservations.
Right, and certainly must be difficult to think about serving when you do have those reservations about the number of troops and about the things that are happening.
Well, it's always frustrating to be a part of a war that you don't think is going well, or that you don't think is, especially in a war that you think can be won, but maybe we're not doing what we need to do to win it. And I think that makes it frustrating for a lot of troops in Iraq, because they just look around and they know they're part of a great and powerful nation, and yet I'm not sure that we're really doing all that we can do or should be doing to win the war in Iraq.
Well, Seth, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Captain Seth Moulton left the active duty Marines in February and is concerned that an order to recall 2,500 Marines could mean that he'll be returning to Iraq. Just ahead, Hezbollah's been studying Israel to develop its own intelligence capabilities. There's more coming up here and now. Have tentative offers of troops for a peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon. Israel's foreign minister today urged the international community to move quickly, describing the situation as explosive. The ceasefire that went into effect last week ended 34 days of fighting sparked by Hezbollah's capture of two Israeli soldiers during a raid on July 12th. According to Jane's Defense Weekly, that raid and subsequent rocket attacks on Israel demonstrate some of Hezbollah's intelligence capabilities. Jeremy Binney is an analyst for Jane's Terrorism and Insurgency Center. And Jeremy, the Israelis are famous for their intelligence strengths. Is Hezbollah taking a page from them?
I think certainly that is the case. I think Hezbollah have realized how useful intelligence is. Israel's demonstrated that over the years by infiltrating Palestinian groups, and they've been very successful in doing that. Hezbollah has certainly learned the importance of, one, keeping the Israelis out, making sure their organization isn't infiltrated, and two, trying to find out what the Israelis are doing.
And how is it finding out what the Israelis are doing? How has it developed these apparently stronger intelligence gathering capabilities. Is it recruiting inside Israel?
We believe that they are, and they already have fairly good relationships with various Palestinian militant groups, especially the Islamic Jihad and, to a lesser extent, maybe Hamas. And the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. But I think what's probably more important here is the connection to the Arab community living inside Israel as Israeli citizens.
The Arab community living inside Israel, you said?
Yeah, as Israeli citizens rather than as Palestinians. Now, some of these guys are apparently increasingly disenfranchised with the state of Israel, and they're part of they're poorer Israelis as well, so they can be susceptible to Hezbollah subversion and offers of money, and a few guys have been arrested under suspicion of spying for Hezbollah. What they're doing is going around looking at Israeli military facilities and Israeli movements to try and build up a picture of what's going on along that border.
So what is Hezbollah's most significant intelligence strength, would you say? Is it the ability to infiltrate and get information, or is it equipment? What is it?
Well, I think the most surprising attacks in the recent fighting, one was when they hit an Israeli warship with an anti-ship missile, which the Israelis did not know Hezbollah had.
Where did that missile come from?
Well, it's an Iranian version of a Chinese anti-ship missile. And the second surprise, when they targeted an Israeli command and control facility. Now, they have been flying over drones, unmanned aerial vehicles over Israel at least twice over the last year or so, and whether this has provided sort of accurate intelligence in terms of looking for clusters of antennas at around Israeli military facilities. But it seems that they were very well aware that this was a fairly central operational hub for the Israeli military. So if they could do some significant damage there, then maybe they could slow the IDF down a bit. They didn't do that much damage, but I think it still came as a shock to the Israelis.
So they seem to have more knowledge than expected, and they also seem to have equipment from Iran.
Yeah, that's true. And the Israelis claim they found really quite sophisticated eavesdropping equipment in Hezbollah bunker, which they managed to capture. And we're talking about something, equipment here, that can actually listen to the Israeli military signals. At what level and whether they were capable of decoding those signals, I don't know. But they're certainly trying to develop this kind of capability, and very much in conjunction with Iran, which also wants to get good intelligence on Israel for its own purposes. That is, we pretty much see that as a joint effort.
I read that Hezbollah apparently has some strengths in so-called preventative intelligence. There was a rumor that Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah hasn't used a phone since he started heading the group in 1992.
That's the sort of rumor which demonstrates how sensitive they are. What is clear is that the Israelis would have dearly liked to have taken him out and were incapable of finding out where he was. Some rumors that he might have been in Damascus, but no one really knew. And unlike with the Palestinian groups, where the Israelis had been fairly effective in decapitating them by taking out militant leaders, they were really ineffective against the hierarchy of Hezbollah here. And that sort of element to their campaign really didn't work at all.
And so what do you see in the future? You write about Hezbollah intelligence inside Lebanon. Do you think that there's at least a suggestion here anyway that the Lebanese government will never be able to really control Hezbollah?
I don't think you can really demand that the Lebanese government even attempt to disarm Hezbollah at this stage. What you need to try and do is swing the political situation in Lebanon against Hezbollah, and maybe people there don't want a repeat of this recent conflict. So that we need to, they'll be less supportive if Hezbollah is provokes Israel again. But that was the sort of presumption before the recent hostilities, and the Lebanese people, especially the Shia community, really got behind them, and they weren't seemingly that upset that so many civilians got killed and so many of their houses were destroyed. That was a real demonstration of how entrenched they are, especially in southern Lebanon and certain suburbs of Beirut. So it's a very tough enemy here, but I think definitely supporting the Lebanese government and building up its military capabilities is going to be fairly important from the international community's perspective.
We heard from an Israeli columnist yesterday who said that this recent fighting, he described it as only being round one. If that's accurate, and if Hezbollah has significant intelligence strengths, that would suggest that there could be some big problems ahead. Would you say that that's a logical conclusion?
Hezbollah has basically established itself as the most effective anti-Israeli force that the Arab world has ever seen. Also, the extent of the support from Iran in terms of sophisticated weaponry has been really important to them. At the same time, they really have learned their lessons from two decades of fighting the Israeli military. So they are really an extremely effective guerrilla force.
Jeremy, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Jeremy Binney is an analyst for Jane's Terrorism and Insurgency Center. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science, Boston, and the National...
The upcoming Republican primary for a U.S. Senate seat is generating interest from around the country. Incumbent Senator Lincoln Chafee has been no ally of the White House. In fact, he was the only Republican to vote against the Iraq War. Nevertheless, prominent Republicans are supporting Chafee in what's become a tough race against the more conservative candidate, the mayor of Cranston, Rhode Island, Stephen Laffey. The two meet in a debate tonight. Joining us to talk about this race is Darrell West. He's professor of political science at Brown University. Darrell, welcome.
Thank you very much.
This campaign between Senator Chafee and Steve Laffey has been called the flip side of the battle in Connecticut between Senator Joseph Lieberman and Ned Lamont, just a nearby New England state. I'm wondering, can you explain exactly why it's the flip side and what's happening here?
The parallel is that both Chafee and Lieberman are moderates facing a grassroots rebellion within their own party. In the case of Lieberman, it was Democrats upset with that senator's support for the Iraq War who recruited Ned Lamont and waged a very strong grassroots campaign against him. In Rhode Island, we have a conservative candidate who is upset with the fact that Chafee voted against the Iraq War, against the Bush tax cuts, and even voted against George Bush in the 2004 presidential campaign. So they've been organizing, and it's a very competitive Republican primary.
Senator Chafee has distanced himself from the White House several times. He's the only Republican, really, to vote against the Iraq War, and now the White House is actually supporting him here. Can you explain that?
Chafee does have strong support from the entire state and national Republican Party. Laura Bush has been in to campaign on behalf of Senator Chafee. John McCain has been here. And the National Republican Senatorial Committee has actually run ads on behalf of Lincoln Chafee against his opponent, Stephen Laffey.
So is it because there are concerns that Stephen Laffey can't win statewide then?
Public opinion polling suggests that Laffey would lose a general election by 30 percentage points to the Democrat. Rhode Island, typically, when it has elected Republicans, elects moderate Republicans, not conservative ones. And so the difficulty Laffey will have if he does win the primary is convincing that general election audience that he's not too conservative for the state.
Now, Laffey, you say, may be too conservative in Rhode Island, which tends to go, if it does go Republican, goes moderate Republican. But I'm wondering how much of Laffey's personality also is involved here. He's the mayor of Cranston, and it's my understanding he's very colorful, uses a bullhorn to announce his presence and those kinds of things. Are those backfiring on him, would you say?
Laffey is a very strong personality. He's a smart and articulate individual who's campaigning very hard. He's running an unconventional campaign in the sense that he's doing a lot of door-to-door activity. And, you know, it's something you see in a mayor's race, but typically you don't see it in a U.S. Senate campaign. But he's somebody who is well-funded, has basically almost matched Chafee in terms of fundraising. This is a very serious primary challenge for Lincoln Chafee.
The war, big issue. Is that the biggest? And what are some of the main issues that are getting a lot of play between the two candidates?
The war has been an issue, although in Chafee's case, he voted against the war, although Laffey is the one who has come out in favor of the resignation of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. So he has also been critical. There's also been a lot of attention devoted to the tax and spend issue. The Club for Growth, a national organization, has come in and run ads on behalf of Stephen Laffey, saying Chafee is just a tax and spend liberal.
Lincoln Chafee's Wide World of Wasteful Spending. Chafee voted to spend $200 million on the Bridge to Nowhere in Alaska, $50 million for an indoor rainforest in Iowa, and $500,000 on the Montana Sheep Institute. Then, Chafee voted for higher income, Social Security, and gas taxes. Over $1 trillion in higher taxes. Lincoln Chafee's spending is just too taxing.
The ad campaigns have already gone thermonuclear. We've had a lot of negative ads going back months and months. The Club for Growth has run an ad against Chafee now, saying he's a tax and spend liberal. Chafee has responded by running an ad entitled Bully, basically making the argument, this guy does not have the proper temperament to be in the U.S. Senate, and he is a bully by nature of his personality.
Do you want Steve Laffey speaking for you in the U.S. Senate? As mayor, he taunted firefighters who opposed his policies. When a woman criticized Laffey's tax increases, he mocked her, saying he'd foreclose on her home if she didn't pay up. And on radio, Laffey said, luckily, seniors who didn't support his campaign were older and dying.
We're older and they're dying.
Steve Laffey, the wrong voice for Rhode Island in the Senate.
With all the TV ads, has this been a very expensive race?
This will be the most expensive campaign in Rhode Island history. I'm not sure exactly where it's going to end up, but we could easily see this become a $15 million race, which, you know, for a state as small as Rhode Island, I mean, we have 660,000 registered voters in this state. This will probably be the most expensive campaign on a per voter basis this year of anywhere in the country.
And how are those ads being received? Are people tired of hearing them, just thinking it's negative campaigning, or are they really, you know, getting some traction?
I think people don't like the style of negative discourse, but we also have had debates, and voters are getting a chance to compare these individuals side by side.
How do they do in the debates? Senator Chafee hasn't always done well in debates in the past.
The interesting thing about the debates is you can clearly see how the candidates are targeting different audiences. I mean, Laffey is really focusing on the traditional conservative Republican base. You know, he's supporting Bush's tax cuts, has been more supportive of Bush's foreign policy, and has criticized Chafee for voting against the president's agenda. Chafee, on the other hand, I think recognizes Laffey has a stronghold on the conservative part. He is really trying to go for independents. Independents number 50% of the electorate in Rhode Island, and I think Chafee realizes he has to get a big turnout from independents, otherwise he's going to lose his primary.
Really? Now, there's a debate in Rhode Island tonight. Do you expect those strategies to continue to be at play here with Steve Laffey trying to play to conservatives and Chafee really playing to the independents?
I think that will be the case. This will be the first TV debate, and it is being broadcast in prime time, so the viewing audience should be very substantial for this.
So you think that there is a significant threat to Senator Chafee here. Do you think that if he didn't win, there would be a chance that he would take a page from Senator Lieberman and become an independent?
As recently as 2 weeks ago, he gave a clear and categorical no. Part of the problem is the filing deadline in Rhode Island is at the end of June, and so even if he wanted to follow that strategy, the only way he could do it would be on a write-in basis, which, of course, would be nearly impossible to pull off. So I think if he loses the primary, he's out.
Mm-hmm. At this point, are you making any predictions, Daryl?
It's a very close and competitive primary. I think there will be a big turnout. There will be lots of independents coming into that primary. Chafee, I think, benefits from the fact there is not a very actively contested Democratic primary for Senate. So I think there's a chance Chafee will eke by in this primary, but it's going to be very close. And even if he wins, he faces a very tough general election battle against a Democrat show at the White House.
Daryl West, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Daryl West is a professor of political science at Brown University. You're listening to Here and Now. As college freshmen prepare for the new school year, some students are scrambling to find a vaccine that could prevent potentially deadly meningitis. Many universities now require students to get vaccinated with Menactra. That's a drug that prevents some forms of meningococcal disease. The maker of the drug says about 10 million Americans need the vaccine, but only 6 million shots are available this year. Some college students are now paying as much as $150 for the vaccine at private health clinics. Joining us with more is Dr. Tom Clark. He's an epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And Dr. Clark, first of all, what is meningococcal disease?
Meningococcal disease is a bacterial infection caused by a bacteria called meningococcus, or Neisseria meningitidis. It most commonly causes meningitis, which is an infection of the fluid and protective covering of the brain and spinal cord. But it can also cause bloodstream infection and other serious infections.
So what happens if somebody contracts this, and how likely is it that it could have disabling or deadly results?
Well, the good news is meningococcal disease is relatively rare. There are about 6 cases in the U.S. for every 100 million people each year. But if you do get it, the chances of dying from it or being severely disabled are pretty common. Something like 10 or 15% of people will die from the infection, and then another 15 to 20% will have long-term adverse problems because of it, either hearing loss or cognitive dysfunction or mental retardation, or even limb loss from amputations because of the effects of the infection.
And college freshmen are at increased risk. Why? How is it transmitted?
It's carried in the nose and throats, and it's transmitted from person to person by oral secretions, or what we'd call large respiratory droplets. So it requires very close contact with a carrier to transmit the bacteria. But a very small proportion, less than 1 in 100 people who are carriers, actually develop invasive disease.
Now, the maker of the vaccine, of Menactra, says that the vaccine is recommended for about 10 million Americans, 2 million college freshmen, also 11 and 12-year-olds, and high school freshmen. Now, the company says, though, even though 10 million Americans might need it, it has only 6 million doses this year. Do we know why we don't have more of this vaccine?
Initially, when the vaccine was licensed a year or so ago and recommended, it was recognized by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices that supply might be an issue. It just takes a while to ramp up production, but at the same time, we weren't exactly sure how quickly providers would take up the recommendations and start using the vaccine. And Sanofi, the manufacturer, has planned for a long time to increase production over time, and they're building a new production facility which will greatly improve the supply of the vaccine. That it just takes time to do that.
Now, this vaccine, it may prevent one type of meningococcal disease, but not all types. Is that right?
The most important thing, really, is that the serogroups covered by the vaccine account for about 75 to 85% of cases in the U.S., so kids will be protected against most cases of meningitis.
And how long does immunization last? How long are they protected?
It is expected to provide immunity at least 8 years and maybe more, and we'll continue to monitor the effectiveness in people who've been vaccinated over time.
So if a high school freshman receives it, they don't need it for their college freshman year necessarily.
Right. If high school freshmen are vaccinated when they start high school, then they should still be protected when they enter college.
What recommendations is the CDC making because of this apparent shortage?
Right now, we're recommending continuing to vaccinate high school freshmen and college freshmen, but deferring vaccination in the 11 to 12-year-olds until the supply improves.
So if a parent right now is looking for a vaccine for a child to go to school, what's their option, best option, really, of finding it?
Really, we recommend being persistent. Try their pediatrician or their family doctor. Try the local health department or county health department who may have vaccine available. Get in touch with an academic medical center or a travel clinic nearby, because this vaccine is also recommended for travelers to sub-Saharan Africa. Check with your college health center and see if they either have vaccine or know of providers who have vaccine. And again, just be persistent.
Dr. Clark, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Sure.
Dr. Tom Clark is an epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. The Chopin Nocturnes are among the most popular in the solo piano repertoire. Dreamy, lyrical, and graceful, they're recognizable even to non-devotees. Italian pianist Maurizio Pollini is known as a master of Chopin's works.
Chopin is not easy music. Even if it has an extraordinary appeal, nevertheless, they had a very deep insight.
It is the deep insides that Pollini reaches for on his new recording of Chopin Nocturnes. Pollini's waited until his 60s to interpret these familiar pieces because he considers them among the great musical tests.
In its depths, is difficult to grasp. And very difficult for the performer to be at the ace of his poetic depths is a challenge, obviously.
Pollini accepted the challenge of playing Ode to Chopin. Here and Now's music critic Tim Riley caught the mood.
At age 65, Maurizio Pollini doesn't have much left to prove. Having scaled the heights of a 30-year career, he's earned special status as a champion of contemporary composers like Anton Webern and Pierre Boulez, turned in more than one cycle of Beethoven sonatas, and wowed audiences in the world's greatest concert halls. So why pay special attention when Pollini releases his Chopin Nocturnes? Well, you can thrill to hear Pollini play note-perfect renditions of Stravinsky's Petrushka or Prokofiev's Sonata No. 7, and he is that rare technician who braves such hailstorms with flair. But among pianists, the greater challenge to playing faster and louder can be to playing softer and more singingly. Chopin's nocturnes are among the most popular melodies in the public's mind, so everybody has their own favorite versions of these musical crystals. Resist that. Chopin's nocturnes are seemingly simple ABA pieces that challenge every aspect of a pianist's technique, from finger control and voicing to mood and emotional shading. But beneath the Polish folk sources, pianists toil to create singing lines with one finger while shaping inner voices with the others. Pollini does all this and more, of course. A master technician with a microscopic attention to detail, his control is masterful. And like a lot of his recordings, you get the overwhelming sense that every note is perfectly placed. But such tightly controlled Chopin may be too fussy for some ears. Pollini's critics say he's too clinical in his approach, too rigorous, at the expense of passion and color. When a young Hugh Grant played the great composer in the 1991 movie Impromptu, he revealed how difficult Chopin found it to write down exactly what he was trying to capture.
I'm not happy with it.
Why?
Because a perfect impromptu should seem spontaneous and free. No one should be able to guess at all the desperate calculation behind it. And I've been struggling with this for so long. It's like being tangled in a net. I feel I have terrible dreams at night. I think if I ever finish it, then it will have finished me.
There's the Chopin challenge, to sound both spontaneous and structured, free-spirited yet controlled. And here was a step the Romantics sought to take after Beethoven, to liberate the music from rules and tradition, to capture the essence of imagination in flight. To succeed at this delicate balance, a pianist must project as much fire as finesse. Chopin reveals something about today's high-profile brand of piano playing. It's immaculate, buffed, and polished to the nth degree, and flawless in its conception, and yet lacking in personality. The great Romantics who played this music brought altogether different virtues. Among great Chopin interpreters, you have to mention Arthur Rubinstein, who, like Chopin, was Polish and a big, colorful personality who projected a regal sense of fun through the music. Here's Rubinstein cutting loose on an especially brilliant passage, sounding as if an idea had suddenly taken hold of his fingers and whisked his imagination away. Now, here's Pollini, our superhero with X-ray vision, in the very same passage. Of course, isolating that one passage does an injustice to the larger context, but what a difference between those two interpretations. Rubinstein sounds as if he might leap off the stage to dance with his listeners. Pollini, by comparison, is a surgeon in full gown with glistening knives and electronic monitors to steady his every move. Rubinstein plays Chopin like he's helping him realize his own composition. Pollini dissects him for a fantastically detailed negative image. It's too simplistic to say Pollini is a clinician to Rubinstein's poet. You could argue that the moments of pathos Pollini strikes are even more effective for the contrast of their exquisite settings. But the truth is, Pollini's scrupulosity is charming in and of itself. It reveals previously hidden layers in these familiar pieces. If the 19th century Romantic era was all about excess and vulnerability, Pollini turns these primary texts into detailed maps of wildly swerving emotions. What could be more modern, more edgy, than making familiar melodies sound like they were carved in stone long before Chopin even wrote them down? It's like listening to a leading anatomist probe the intricacies of the human heart while making the science of it exhilarating.
Italian pianist Maurizio Pollini performing his latest recording of Chopin Nocturnes. You'll find a link to the recordings and to music critic Tim Raleigh's blog at our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Well, goodbye and good luck today to our intern, Lauren Morand, who we know is on her way to becoming a great journalist. Thanks for all your help this summer, Lauren. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now. Our middle schools becoming